Before we head to the episode, please be aware it may contain content that some people find distressing. It is also unsuitable for anybody under the age of 13. Welcome to episode 3 of It's Murder Up North. I cannot believe I am on episode 3. Thank you so much for coming on this journey with me. I'm sat here at my kitchen table with my children tucked up in bed creating this podcast. I'm still learning and I'm bound to make mistakes. If you have any suggestions on what I could add to the podcast or have any cases you'd like me to cover, please let me know. You can contact me via Facebook, Twitter, and you can also check out my YouTube channel. Before I head to the episode, I'd just like to say thank you to a couple of very important people who have offered me support this week. Thank you to David, Zoe, and Friendly Fraggle. Now let's get this episode started. I spent my teens and early 20s in Manchester. I lived in the east of the city, and like many carefree teenagers, I would go shopping, to the cinema, and spend time with my friends. I went everywhere by bus. When I got my first job at a large department store in the city centre, I would often have to walk the half a mile journey from my bus stop to my house in the dark. The route would take me down dimly lit passageways. Believe me, if there was an alternative, I would have taken it. The area at the time was undergoing a lot of regeneration, and this meant that there were a lot of empty boarded up houses, so the streets were quite desolate. It was a frightening walk for a 17-year-old, and as I'd make my way home, I'd keep an eye on those shadows, just to make sure nobody was lurking there. I am so glad I only learned about this serial killer after I moved away from the area. As in the 1970s, a killer stalked girls in the very area I used to live. Back in the 1970s, fear filled the streets of northern cities after a spate of deaths in Bradford, Leeds and Manchester. These were perpetrated by the notorious Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper. His reign of terror overshadowed the murderous deeds of another serial killer who was also on the prowl on the streets of Manchester. This killer and his crimes have all but been forgotten. He was Trevor Hardy, the Beast of Manchester. Trevor Hardy was born in Manchester on the 11th of June 1945. His parents were hardworking and well-respected members of the community. His dad took particular pride in ensuring that his children were well-mannered and well-behaved. For the early years of his life, Trevor was the youngest child. And this came with the usual luxuries of being the baby of the family. He was doted on by his mother, protected by his siblings, and his father was a little more lenient. This all changed when Trevor was about 7, with the arrival of his baby brother, Colin. Shortly after this change in his home life, Trevor began acting out. He started getting into trouble at school, and would be responsible for petty thefts in the area. As his little brother Colin grew up in a loving household, Trevor began to spend more time in Borstal, predecessor to a young offenders institution. Trevor used to boast about his abilities to break into houses. During the 1950s and 60s, it was normal for people to leave their doors unlocked while the kids played out on the street and they hung their washing out in the yard. This made it so easy for Trevor to enter homes and steal valuables. He took pride in the fact that he only stole things that could not be traced, like cash. By the age of 15, the troubled teen was sentenced to a year in Strangeways prison for burglary. On sentencing Trevor, the judge stated that the public needed to be protected from him. For Trevor's family, this was a source of great shame. They found themselves ostracised from the community they were once a part of. This particularly hurt his dad and drove a wedge between father and son. Trevor built up an extensive criminal record, and in his early 20s, he was sent to prison again for indecent exposure. Trevor's criminal behaviour became more violent as he got older, and intensified when he consumed alcohol. He didn't need to drink a lot for his volatile nature to be seen. He had been banned from numerous pubs for causing fights, And one night, his volatile attitude would lead to his first serious assault. While drinking in one of the pubs he wasn't banned from, he sat at the bar chatting to another man. They were having fun when suddenly Trevor became aggressive and attacked the man with a pickaxe, striking him about the body and head. His victim survived this attack, but his life was changed forever. Trevor was sentenced for 5 years and was sent to a prison on the Isle of Wight, which sits just off the south coast of England. Tragically, his victim would later die from complications caused by the injuries he suffered, all because of a disagreement over who was going to buy the next round of drinks. Upon his release from prison, he met Sheila Farrow, and the couple moved in together. They'd often be seen in the local pubs of the Moston area of Manchester. She was a bit older than him, and he was often overheard saying that she was his mother figure. On an early morning in July 1975, a dog walker made a gruesome discovery. As they passed a building site, their attention was drawn to a pile of bricks. When priests arrived at the scene, they discovered the body of a teenage girl concealed beneath a sheet of cardboard. She lay on her back, partially dressed and barefoot. Her face had been beaten to the point she was unrecognisable, and her eyes had been removed. Her body bore signs of a severe attack. The police searched the area, but they were unable to find any way of identifying the victim. An autopsy revealed the full depravity of the murder. The young girl had been sexually assaulted, her body mutilated. Bite marks were found on her body, and one bite had removed her nipple. The perpetrator's vile acts didn't end there. They found the girl's missing eyeballs in her abdominal wounds. 200 yards away from the horrific discovery, the Scala family were concerned that their daughter Wanda hadn't returned home from work. The night before, Wanda was working as a barmaid at a local pub. She was 17 years old and was due to be home by 1 a.m. I've been unable to find much information about Wanda. I would have loved to have told you more about who she was and what she was like, but unfortunately her murder was only covered briefly by the local press, so not much is known about her. A couple of days later, the police were called back to the crime scene to discover that the perpetrator had returned and left Wanda's missing shoes next to where her body had lain. This just goes to show how brazen this killer was, to return to a crime scene just days after he had committed his crime. It was like he was taunting the police. Colin Hardy tried to avoid his brother, and for months he had been successful. But one day he went to visit his parents and was shocked to discover Trevor and his girlfriend Sheila were there. Trevor insisted that Colin join him for a drink, and reluctantly the little brother agreed. The whole time he was with his brother, Colin felt uncomfortable. He knew what a volatile character he could be. The trio sat in the pub, enjoying their drinks, when Trevor began to talk about the horrific murder of a teenage girl that had been in the papers. Colin grew increasingly uneasy. As the more drink Trevor consumed, the more he talked about the girl's death. Colin confronted him and asked him what his interest was in this crime. Trevor, as calm as anything, as if he was just describing what he bought from the shops that day, responded, "'Cause I did it." Colin was stunned. He didn't know what to think or say. He found himself being escorted home by Trevor and Sheila. And once inside the house, Trevor began to brutally attack his brother. He beat him to the point of unconsciousness. And then he turned to Colin's wife and politely asked, "Could you make me some beans on toast? I feel hungry, I've not had any tea." While Colin lay on the floor, motionless, Trevor sat down at the kitchen table and ate his beans on toast, and then he and Sheila left. Following the assault, although scared for his life, Colin decided to report his brother's confession to the police. Police took the report seriously, and they brought Trevor in for questioning. He denied the confession and claimed he didn't know what Colin was talking about. He stated he was at home with Sheila all night when Wanda was murdered, and Sheila corroborated this. The police sought other methods to tie Hardy to the crime. They decided to take bite mark impressions to compare against the marks on Wanda's body, but they didn't match, so they had to let Trevor go. Trevor was filled with vengeful anger as he hammered on the door of Colin's house. He burst through the door and fled up the stairs to find Colin. Fortunately, the commotion had been reported to the police, and within minutes, police were there dragging Trevor out of the house. It was written off as a domestic disturbance and no further action was taken. Hardy's face would soon appear on the front page of the Manchester Evening News newspaper. Finally, his behaviour had been picked up on by the local press, as they hailed him a hero. Don't worry, you heard me correct. I said he was hailed a hero. The news reported that a fire had broken out at a house in Moston, and Trevor, as a good neighbour and good Samaritan, had rescued the family from the flames, hence why he was hailed a hero. What the news report didn't state was the following investigation into how the fire started. The conclusion of the investigation found that the fire had started deliberately, and Trevor Hardy was the one who started it. I'm presuming he would have been punished for this arson attack. However, I could not find any records of his punishment. In March of 1976, another body was found, as the naked body of Sharon Mossoff was pulled from the canal in the Failsworth area of the city. Sharon was a 17-year-old girl who lived in Failsworth. The day before her body was found, she had asked her parents to accompany her to a works party. However, her parents had declined, stating that she'd have more fun without them there. At midnight, Sharon called her parents. She wanted to check which bus she'd needed to catch home. That was the last time they would speak to their daughter. As police began the investigation on the towpath, a crowd gathered. Amongst them was Sharon's dad. He'd been told by a neighbour that the police were down by the canal, just 200 yards away from his home. Concerned that his daughter hadn't returned home the night before, he headed down there, but as he walked closer to the scene, he instinctively knew that his little girl was dead. Sharon had been strangled with her own tights and struck about the head before being dropped into the canal. Upon examination of the body, a connection was made between Sharon and Wanda's murders. Both girls had been struck about the head and they had bite marks. Both girls had had their nipples bitten off. Trevor had gone into hiding. He was a wanted man after a vicious attack on a lady in a nightclub. He had tried to strangle her, but the attack was disturbed and he ran away. Fortunately, his victim survived. Unable to find Trevor, the police turned to the one person they thought would know where he was. The police knocked at the door of Sheila Farrow, and as they sat on her sofa with a cup of tea, she began to talk. She told them she didn't know where Trevor was, and that they were no longer together. She claimed she couldn't vouch for his movements on the night of Sharon's death. However, she had a confession to make. She had lied to the police. Trevor was not with her on the night of Wanda's murder, and she didn't know where he was. All she knew is that she was at home alone. This lie helped Trevor walk free. It helped him commit another murder. I don't know why she lied. I don't know how she has lived with this lie. Police finally tracked Trevor down to a property in Stockport, where they found him hiding in the loft. He was arrested and brought in for questioning regarding the murder of Wanda and Sharon. During his interrogation, Hardy would shock police with new revelations. He told them that when he was arrested for Wanda's murder, he knew that they would take teeth impressions, so he had a nail file smuggled into his cell and filed down his teeth so they would not match the bite marks. Anyone who's had a raw nerve on their teeth will know that this hurts like hell. It shows the depravity and extent at which Hardy was willing to go to avoid being caught. But Trevor's revelations didn't stop there. He was about to confess that Wanda wasn't his first murder. 18 months earlier, just 6 weeks after he had been released from prison, he bumped into a young girl on New Year's Eve. She was heading to a party. He claimed he thought she was an ex-girlfriend who had scorned him whilst he was in prison. He brutally attacked her, stabbing her in the neck, and then he disposed of her body in a shallow grave. Not only did he bury her body, but he returned to the site numerous times to mutilate and dismember the body. He scattered parts about the field where he had buried her and threw her head into a nearby lake. Her name was Janet Leslie Stewart. She was just 15 years old. She lived in the Harper Hay area of Manchester and worked at the Bellevue Entertainment Complex. Tragically, she lived just 100 yards away from where her body was found. For 18 months, her parents had been wondering where their daughter had gone. They'd reported her missing, but the case soon went cold. When asked why he killed the girls, Trevor claimed that Leslie was mistaken identity. He thought she was his 14-year-old girlfriend, who, whilst he was in prison, had met another boy. He stated that Wanda was a mugging gone wrong, and Sharon was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. She disturbed him whilst he was breaking into a hardware store. He went on to explain that after he disposed of Sharon's body in the canal, he returned later, jumped into the cold water, and retrieved the body. He then mutilated it in an attempt to hide the bite marks that would have linked Sharon and Wanda's cases. If Colin hadn't gone to the police and reported Trevor's confession, Trevor probably would never have been on the police's radar, and he would probably have been free to continue killing. Trevor Hardy was handed a whole life sentence, which basically meant he would never be released from prison. He died in 2012. It was believed he was also responsible for another murder in the Manchester area. Just 2 weeks after his release from prison, there were a number of similarities between this murder and the ones that Hardy had committed. The girl had been struck about the head with a brick and sexually assaulted, her body dumped behind the Spread Eagle pub in Colliehurst. Her name was Dorothy Layden, and she was just 17 years old. Unfortunately, police were unable to find any evidence that connected Hardy to this murder, and today her case is still unsolved. The hardest part of putting this episode together was that I could find no information on the three girls. I'd like to provide you with information of who they were before they became murder victims, tell you about their life and what they liked and loved. However, in this case, every documentary and newspaper article I read, they were just footnotes in the Trevor Hardy story. So tragically, I could not give you the information I wanted. All I know is that these were three beautiful teenage girls who were just becoming independent and their lives were viciously taken from them. Trevor Hardy is the forgotten serial killer, but what's worse is his victims being forgotten as well. Thank you so much for joining me for episode 3 of It's Murder Up North. I would love to know your thoughts on the case. Have you heard of Trevor Hardy? I admit, despite living in Manchester, I had not heard of him. And to be honest, that's a good thing. I think I would have been a little more terrified on my journey home from work. And what are your thoughts on Sheila? Do you think she lied out of love or out of fear? And what do you think made Trevor the person he was? Apparently after his death, Colin was sent Trevor's belongings, and in them he found letters claiming that Colin was responsible for Dorothy Layden's murder. Trevor also blamed his parents for his upbringing, saying it was their fault that he behaved the way he did. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Please follow me on Twitter, on Facebook at It's Murder Up North, and check out my YouTube channel. Episode 4 will be coming soon. In the meantime, keep an eye on those shadows. Goodbye.